You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Ted Pacon. I'm a senior fellow in the Latin America Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings. And I welcome you to today's discussion about Venezuela, the refugee crisis, challenges, and solutions. As you know, the Summit of the Americas is meeting as we speak, trying to address this problem through some kind of regional response. So it'll be very interesting to see if there will be any consensus toward a more coherent and generous regional response. As you know, Venezuela has really become the poster child for how a combination of corruption, economic mismanagement, and undemocratic governance can lead to widespread suffering and a spreading humanitarian crisis. We have on the economic front a real collapse of the economy, soaring inflation, massive currency devaluation, dramatic declines in oil production, which is, of course, the foundation of Venezuela's economy. Caracas is now one of the most dangerous cities in the world. On the political side, President Maduro is ruling like an autocrat. There is no real viable check on his power. We have elections scheduled there next month, which are already declared illegitimate by several governments in the region, including the United States. On the humanitarian front, we have shortages of basic medicines as the primary care infrastructure collapses, massive increases in disease, increases in child and maternal mortality, hunger, and malnutrition. Aid delivery, well, international aid delivery is not getting in. Domestic aid delivery is politicized. And there's a serious brain drain that's affecting the healthcare services as well. We're not going to be able to address all of these problems of the conflict. Today's focus is on the situation of migrants and refugees. And to help us, we have a fantastic panel of people, policymakers who are actually engaged with this problem in the U.S. government and at the United Nations. We'll hear from, in our panel, Karen Freeman is the Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance at USAID, a long title. You all have their bios, so I won't go into detail. She has served in many different places around the world, including in Kenya, in Pakistan, early days in her career in Central America, in El Salvador, Ethiopia, Zimbabwe, etc. We're also joined by Matthew Reynolds, is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees representative for the United States and the Caribbean. He has spent 30 years in government service, handling humanitarian response, oversight, and management, and a very interesting career working on legislative affairs here in Washington at the State Department and on Capitol Hill. So it'll be very helpful to get his political antenna on how we can move forward on this issue. We also have today Marta Costanzo Youth, who is the Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary in the State Department's Bureau for Population, Refugees, and Migration. She handles Central Asia and the Americas. That's an interesting combination. Longstanding career diplomat, has served as Deputy Chief of Mission in Managua, also in our embassies in Ottawa and Quito, South Africa. So it's really a fantastic group. We're going to be moderating, led by the moderation today will be led by Danny Bahar. Danny is a David Rubenstein Fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program, and he works closely with Ernesto Talvi, who's here with us today visiting from Uruguay. He directs CETAS, a think tank in Montevideo, and helps run our economic and social policy initiative in the Global Economy and Development Program. Danny's an economist, Israeli and Venezuelan, does a lot of very technical and interesting work on productivity and structural transformation, but including in that the role of migration in economic transformation. So he has just come back from Cúcuta, Colombia, where he spent time on the border talking to refugees and service providers, so we'll get a firsthand view, and he's going to introduce the first segment, which will be a video from an official in Colombia. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to Brookings. This is fun.
Yes.
Welcome to Brookings. My name is Danny Bahar. Thank you, Ted, for the introduction. Before I invite the panelists to join, let me tell you a little bit of what I lived throughout the past week. I just came from spending 2.5 days in Cúcuta, which is the bordering city with Venezuela. And I met tens, dozens of Venezuelan migrants or refugees, really with terrifying stories. Every person I met, they had a very horrible background story behind it. I don't think I just randomly met the 20 or 30 people with the worst stories. I think that really every person that went by had a terrible story. I found very roughly two profiles of people crossing the border. The first group is those that are crossing for the day or for the week, some of them to work and bring some money back to Venezuela. They're not able to get a decent job with a decent pay in Venezuela. I've met people who are crossing just to buy groceries and medicines and just coming back. I've met people that are coming for humanitarian purposes to go to a hospital to vaccinate their babies because there are no vaccines in Venezuela. I saw a lot of children going to school at 6 a.m. in the morning. Probably they will be coming back in the afternoon. I saw a lot of people crossing just to eat in some of the public dining halls that for charity, the Catholic Church and other organizations are putting for the people, and then coming back. But I also saw a lot of people leaving Venezuela for good, some of them with a bag, some of them with nothing on them, using their lifetime savings to go into uncertainty. Some of them are planning to stay in Colombia. Some of them are taking buses to go beyond Colombia. There were like 12 bus companies just as you cross the border taking people to places like Ecuador, Argentina, Chile. So just imagine this is a bus with 40 people that it takes them 6 or 7 or 9 days to get to their destination. And you know, when you are there, you realize that this is not a normal border. As far as I'm concerned, I don't think it's normal to cross a border and see Red Cross tents treating people as they cross. You're welcome to see my Twitter feed, at @Danny_Bahar, a lot of these stories. And I'm telling you, I unfortunately won't be able to get in details on those, but let me tell you a little bit about the macro situation. The Colombian government has done a lot. They have put a lot of efforts to provide some legal status to these people crossing, to treat them in their public hospitals, allowing children to go to school. This has come at a cost to them, and they're looking for help. There are many, many other non-governmental institutions on the ground, the Catholic Church standing out as one of them. I went to some of the dining halls that they're putting together. The number they told us that they've served 400,000 hot meals in the past 8 months. This is not counting meals that are not hot. So they also giving out sometimes some dry food for people to eat, or the Red Cross is providing first aid assistance as people cross the border, as I said. But there's so much that the Colombian government alone can do, or the other governments can do on their own, and that's why part of this forum is to think constructively, how can the international community help? My feeling on the ground was that this is a crisis. Governments in the region are not calling this a crisis yet, and there might be political reasons for it. There's a big discrepancy on the numbers, and we're going to get to that. And we tried very hard to get some representative from a South American country here today with us. It was very hard to do so, but I was fortunate enough to meet Felipe Muñoz, who's President Santos' envoy to the border, to deal with the border. His title is the border manager. And he actually sent us a video in which he's going to explain a little bit in detail what they have been done. So let's watch this video, and then we'll start a conversation.
Good morning, everybody. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. My name is Felipe Muñoz. I was designated a couple of months ago by President Juan Manuel Santos as manager of the Colombia-Venezuela border. My job is coordinating all the actions that the Colombian government has put forth to attend the Venezuelan migration. I'm coordinating the action within the government, with local authorities around the country, and with international cooperation. I would like to begin by making a quick balance on how this process has been. This process began in 2015, when the Venezuelan government expelled more than 22,000 Colombians during a one-week period. This required a massive response from the Colombian government to establish control units at the three main border points with Venezuela that are located in the departments of Guajira, Norte de Santander, and Arauca. With the participation of many state entities and a quick response plan, we were able to address this problem effectively. In a six-month period, the Colombian government was able to manage and control the situation, but it was time enough to realize that there was a significant increase in the migration that needed monitoring. The second stage of this process came in 2017, when a highest percentage of Venezuelan migrants arrived to Colombia territory, as well as to other South American countries. It is important to say that the Venezuelan migration is not just a phenomenon happening in Colombia, but it is creating humanitarian problems in other countries of South America as well. To give some figures to you about the situation, the International Organization for Migration estimates that in Mediterranean, 170,000 migrants moved to Europe. In comparison, those same figures show that the number of people that have left Venezuela in the last 2 years may be approaching 1.8 million migrants. This is therefore 10 times the situation in the Mediterranean. In this sense, Colombia is the largest migrant recipient of a phenomenon that is acquiring regional characteristics. During this stage, which began in June 2017, the Colombian government took a series of measures to address the migrant population. With the health measures, more than 25,000 Venezuelans have been attended free of charge in emergency room of the Public Emergency Service Network. We had put forward education measure as well to ensure the Venezuelan children can continue with their education. Today, there are about 30,000 children in Colombia public school. But there are also childcare measures. With this strategy, more than 25 Venezuelan children and adolescents have been assisted in the Colombian childcare system. And also, migration measures were implemented. For example, the government created a special transit car to maintain control in the border and a special permit to stay that guarantees a legal status for Venezuelan migrants in the country and gives them the possibility of being in Colombia for a two-year period. As time passed and increasing the migration continued, additional measures were taken this year in February by President Santos. Not only did the flow of Venezuelan migrants to Colombia continue to grow, but the percentage of Venezuela who transit through Colombia territory to go through Ecuador and to other countries in the region has also increased substantially. Within these new measures, there are control and security measures, because though the Colombian government has been generous and supportive with the Venezuelan migrant situation, this phenomenon requires to be managed with security and control. These measures include the registration of irregular migrants that we began last week. The registration for Venezuelan migrants in Colombia is one of the largest registers in the world. In 2 months, we hope to register all Venezuelans who have entered the country without documents, in order to know their situation and to be able, as a government, to establish some modification or extension of humanitarian public policy that the Colombian government is already implementing. In addition, other measures were created to support Colombian returnees. As you may know, a significant percentage of those returning from Venezuela have the right to be Colombian because they are children of either a Colombian father or a mother. And there too, the government has a specific program for this population. All this within the framework of a need for resources. As you may see, the Colombian government has invested many resources in this process and will continue to do so. but we need the help of international cooperation. And we are working not only with the United States government, with the United Nations and all its agencies, with the European Union and all the NGOs to make this process coordinated and effective. But we need resources, especially for very specific health issues. There are risks in epidemiological diseases, and the cost in vaccination and prevention issues are increasing. Many Venezuelan migrants arrive in very critical health conditions, and we need to reinforce this process. Just this is a quick overview to begin this discussion and to tell you and to reiterate to you that the Colombian government has been taking care of the situation and continues to do so. It is an issue of highest priority for the president, the foreign minister, and the government. My last message is that here in Colombia, the government and state entities will continue to act with solidarity and generosity, but also with security and control criteria. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. So,
let me welcome the panel, so please join us here. In the meantime, I want to say I encourage you to tweet about this event and use the hashtag Venezuela Refugee Crisis if you are in the Twitter world. Great. So, well, thank you so much for joining us. I know taking some time from your busy schedules to join us here this morning. I want to start by asking a question to Mr. Reynolds from UNHCR. There was a recent, the UNHCR recently published a guidance note, which I have here on the Venezuelan migration crisis, where they are encouraging the receiving states to consider the application of the Cartagena Declaration in the cases of Venezuelan asylum seekers, including as a basis for accelerated or simplified case processing. So for those of you who don't know, the Cartagena Declaration was adopted in 1984 by 10 Latin American countries, including Venezuela and Colombia. And it expands the original definition of a refugee that was established in 1951, and then it was expanded in 1967. And the Cartagena Declaration definition of a refugee says that refugees are people who flee their country because their lives, security, or freedom have been threatened by generalized violence, foreign aggression, internal conflicts, massive violation of human rights, or other circumstances which have seriously disturbed public order. It further says, the note says, UNHCR considers that the broad circumstances leading the outflow of Venezuelan nationals would fall within the spirit of the Cartagena Declaration. So the first question for you is, there is not a wide recognition in the region that most of these migrants are refugees. And the question is, in your opinion, can we call them refugees? How easily would it be to classify them as refugee? What are the steps? What are the requirements legally and practically for the international community with UNHCR leading the efforts to really boost support for the efforts on the ground based on whether they are or not called refugees?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Danny. And I'd like to thank Brookings for holding this important event at this time, particularly as the situation surrounding Venezuela continues to grow and become increasingly problematic. As you noted, I mean, the ongoing political and socioeconomic developments have led to, you've mentioned, the outflow of 1.5 million Venezuelans into the neighboring countries. And this is a conservative estimate based on government, area government reporting. So if you think about this, in modern history, Latin America has never experienced an exodus of this dimension. And it could be another million this year. We're seeing flows of about 5,000 people a day. And that's not just through, as you saw in the video, not just through to Colombia, but obviously to other countries in the area fleeing from Colombia into Ecuador, to Peru. We see on the other side, Guyana and the small Caribbean islands. So to date, you have about 146,000 to 147,000 Venezuelans have actually filed asylum claims with an estimated about 444,000 have accessed alternative legal forms of stay in Latin America. As you noted properly and recently, the UNHCR considers the broad circumstances leading to the outflow of Venezuelan nationals to fall within the Cartagena Declaration, with the resulting presumption of international protection needs. So to that end, as you pointed out, and I encourage others to look, we've published it in March, this is just last month, 2018, the guidance note, which, as I said, as was mentioned, encouraged the states to consider the application of this regional definition in the case of Venezuelan asylum seekers, including as a basis for accelerated or simplified case processing. This recognition is becoming increasingly important because as the outflow continues, you may have just been putting the numbers I gave you together to recognize that almost two-thirds of the Venezuelans remain in an irregular situation without documentation, including those who are not able to apply for asylum or another legal status because of bureaucratic obstacles, long waiting periods, high application fees, you know, you name it. So these Venezuelans without access to legal status are particularly vulnerable to exploitation and abuse, and receiving communities are themselves coming under increasing strain, which can undermine peaceful coexistence and feed the manifestations of discrimination and xenophobia. So therefore, you know, the need for a predictable legal status, documentation, shelter, access to health care, and other basic services is acute. And so I think that's why you may not want to be too tied up immediately in all of the sort of legal definitions. The fact of the matter is there is a huge community both of outflow, but also host communities that clearly need assistance and need protection. I'd just kind of point out, too, because as we're all focused on this, to remember that Venezuela itself has generously hosted a large refugee population from the region and other parts of the world for decades. And this generosity should be recognized and reciprocated now by ensuring the timely and effective protection and assistance to Venezuelans who are compelled to leave their country.
Thank you. I want to follow up before passing to the other panelists. I want to ask, would this be a requirement for the governments to declare this as a refugee crisis or to adopt the Cartagena Declaration? Would this be a requirement for UNHCR to play a bigger role in providing aid and boosting the efforts on the ground?
I mean, we're already very much on the ground. It's important to note that there are, as I said, looking just internally within Venezuela, we've got over 100,000 Colombians still in Venezuela in sort of a refugee-like status in existence there. And we are ramping up operations throughout the area, regardless of, I mean, it's important to, and that's why we put out the guidance note, we very much are pursuing and pushing for the important protections that would be required. But UNHCR provides assistance on a needs basis. And the need is clearly there. So you see, and we just recently released a request for a supplemental budget for $46 million, which we know we're expecting a United States contribution because the U.S. is the number one contributor to UNHCR and is always very generous. So I've got my hopes there to address those situations and provide the kind of assistance, the kind of support, the kind of advice that we are providing in all of the areas. You know, in some countries like Colombia, you think of the amount of people, and these are large countries that are already absorbing lots of Venezuelans. But part of my jurisdiction here, I represent the Caribbean area, and in some of the very small Caribbean countries, even a small amount of Venezuelans make a difference. I mean, Aruba has 120,000 people. If you add 30,000 Venezuelans to that, that's Lebanon-sized proportion of refugees.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Freeman, so as we heard from Mr. Munoz, the Colombia's authorities have done a lot, but it seems like they still in the need of important financial resources to be able to provide the help, particularly on the health system. They've been claiming that that's a big limitation for them right now. And USAID recently provided a grant of $2.5 million to help the Venezuelan migrants who are crossing the border. So I was hoping you can tell us a little bit about the purpose of the grant. And looking forward, do you envision continued support from USAID to Colombia, Brazil, to deal with this particular problem? From my feeling of talking to officials, this is a very generous contribution, but it's still very small in terms of what probably will be needed if we start running numbers. So I wonder if you could give us some background on that and what do you see happening forward in terms of aid?
Sure. Thank you. And thanks to Brookings and to my fellow panelists for so dedicatedly following this issue that could easily fall off of the scope these days. We're very concerned at USAID about the humanitarian situation inside Venezuela as well as in the neighboring countries. And I need to be very, very generous in my praise of the Colombian government and the role that they're playing, as well as the countries in the region who are really absorbing the impact of the migration. The administrator announced a $2.5 million package a couple of weeks ago, an emergency food and health assistance for Venezuelans in Colombia and the communities that are hosting them as well. And so not to the entirety of the request, but we do expect that the package will grow, and we are looking at the region with great concern in this movement of people. Not unmindful of the fact that that our programs will need to respond to the people in need in the region. With respect to the program in Colombia itself, within the $2.5 million package, part of that is going to we're working with PAHO, to the Pan American Health Organization. To support immediate efforts. We're also looking, providing the bulk of that $2.5 million through WFP for food assistance. But also looking at working with OCHA and HCR and others to really kind of get ahead of the analytical side of this and get a better idea of what the needs are now and what they're going to be, because as this emergency stretches on and until there is a political solution, the humanitarian solution will never be enough.
Thank you. So, Ms. Youth, I know that you spent some time recently both in Colombia and Brazil. So I hope you can tell us a little bit about that, and particularly in the context of the State Department has a lot of experience in dealing with conflicts that result in a large population of refugees and displaced people. So one of the things I'm curious is, like, how do you compare what you saw in the border to other ongoing conflicts that you've seen? I mean, can you categorize these as economic migrants? Do you see them more really as refugees? Because what I was surprised by being there is that, yeah, right, there's not an armed war happening in Venezuela, but all the humanitarian indices are like countries with war or even worse. So in that sense, I had two parts of this question. First, if you can tell us about that experience, and second, what have been the efforts so far of the U.S. government, the State Department, in dealing in the context of this Venezuelan situation?
Thanks, Danny. So first of all, let me say in all humility, there are folks in the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugee, and Migration who are, if they're Foreign Service officers, they're recidivists, and they go back time and time again for tours there, and our civil servants in the Bureau are kind of devoted to the issues of migration and humanitarian assistance to refugees and the stateless and so forth. I'm only a recent arrival this past year, but they've done a good job kind of inculcating me into the Bureau. So for those of you who are not familiar with the Bureau of Refugee and Migration in the State Department, the PRM, it's known as in the field, it leads U.S. government efforts when there is a refugee and migration crisis, and we look for sustainable solutions for refugees, for people in need of international protection, and for stateless, of which there are many in the world. We have civil servants and foreign service officers here in the State Department and around the world. We have refugee coordinators and local staff who are also amazingly dedicated to these issues. And they liaise with governments, they keep tabs on situations of concerns, and they monitor the assistance that we fund. So we fund UNHCR, and then we monitor them and make sure that they're using our money, the tax, U.S. taxpayer money, efficiently, and to really meet the needs of the people in need of protection and the needs of the host governments. And then where we don't have refugee coordinators and PRM staff specifically, in all of our embassies, I have been amazed at how our staff, and especially in Latin America, our ambassadors have been very engaged in this issue, working with the local governments. We work very closely with USAID in many of these situations, especially with Food for Peace throughout the world during refugee and migration crisis. In terms of what I saw, you know, just before we came in, we were chatting a little bit what I saw recently in Cúcuta, and as well as I went to Boa Vista, which is in Roraima State, right up on the Venezuelan border as well. And essentially, I think it echoes a lot of what Danny was saying. I also don't think I managed to just talk to the people who were most desperate. I think their stories were indicative of many of the people coming out, and they were stories of, a lot of parents I ended up talking to, and these were a lot of parents who didn't want to leave their country, because I think Venezuelans are pretty patriotic, actually, as a country, right? And they didn't want to leave, but finally got to the point where their children were crying at night, they were hungry every day. Their child's school was no longer functioning, and they were worried about their child's future. There was no food to be had, or there was medical treatment that was necessary, and they couldn't get it, and so they had to come out. And so these are desperate choices of desperate people. And I was telling Danny just before that, I met a young mother with this very small child that was supposed to be 2 months old. The mother was very slim. The baby was very smaller than you would expect for a two-month-old. I'm not a medical expert, so I can't say. But, essentially she said, I don't get enough food. There's no way I could feed this child. There's no formula to be had, so I could just stay at home and just slowly watch this child starve to death, or I had to come out and get formula and get medical care. And so these are the desperate and very humbling choices that you hear from people. There are also many people who are out and sending, goods or sending money back to family in Venezuela to help them get through this. So it was a very instructive visit. But I also, to echo Karen and others' comments, it's elsewhere in the world, I think, if this had happened long before we got to the point of 1.7 million displaced Venezuelan or displaced people out of their own country and into other countries, this would have been like on the front page every day long, long time ago. And so you have to give credit to all of the countries in the region who have been amazingly compassionate and generous in taking in, what they referred to as our Venezuelan cousins, right? And Venice and in Colombia especially, there was this sense that, hey, when we had troubles internally, Venezuela took our people in and they hosted them, and there continue to actually be Colombian refugees in Venezuela even to date. And now it's our turn to return the favor. So there was this amazing generosity and compassion. And when you heard Felipe Munoz, I noted that one of the things he kept on talking about was integration, right? So it wasn't like we're hosting them and, we're waiting for them to go back. No, they're trying to integrate them. They're getting them into schools. They're getting medical care. So you have to give these governments a lot of credit. That said, the flows continue. And so I think many governments have reached the point where they are saying, all along now we've been looking to the global experts like UNHCR and IOM to help us through this, but we need more assistance. We need guidance on how to tackle this. And so What the State Department does and through PRM, so essentially we give a contribution by authority. We either fund international organizations, but we also fund NGOs. So in fiscal year 17, we funded $36.5 million in the region. Didn't all go to this Venezuelan crisis, but it's kind of earmarked very loosely for the region so that it can be used for whatever is the emerging crisis. But in addition to that, UNHCR also, we have an emergency fund as part of our contribution. And last year they pulled $3.3 million, I think, dollars from that. So at the early part of the crisis so that we could help out both host governments and meet some of the humanitarian needs of these people just as they needed urgent assistance. So this is, you know, kind of part and parcel. And then going forward, we're looking. UNHCR has their supplementary appeal that's out there. IOM has also the International Organization of Migration has recently put out a regional plan and asked for funding for that. And then the State Department has also put out a NOFO, which is, I guess, a request for proposals. I forget what it all stands for now. But a request for proposals for non-governmental organizations throughout the region, you know, to see what gaps there are, because obviously the international organizations cannot be everywhere, and sometimes there are specific things in specific areas that NGOs somehow are better adapted to handle. And so we're looking also to fund NGOs, and I think that request for proposals closes early next week. And so we hope to. We're still looking at the appeals, but you know we hope to do our best to help with this situation.
Thank you. Well, one of the things that I was struck by is that there's really a lot of disagreement in terms of the official figures or the numbers. There was a recent paper by the International Migration Organization, the Regional Action Plan. Mm-hmm. They're talking about that they said there are a little bit less than a million Venezuelans who have left the country between 2015 and 2017. A UNHCR report says that there are over 1.5 million Venezuelans in the region. I know that these numbers are not exactly comparable, but still, just to give you a sense of all the different numbers that are out there. The Colombian government officially says that there are about 600,000 Venezuelans in the country, including regular and irregular migrants. And there you see a lot of unofficial sources on the field that are saying that the number is even up to 1.5 million Venezuelans in Colombia. So, then when you look at the border itself, officially the numbers are that there are 30,000 people crossing the border every day, and about 3,000 of them are staying in Colombia or traveling further away. Unofficial numbers talk about 70,000 people on average crossing every day and 5,000 staying. We heard from Mr. Munoz there's an effort from the Colombian government to put out a census, basically, to understand this number. I wonder, the definition of a crisis, I think, is when we don't really know what's happening. So it's obvious that we don't really have a good number. But on the other hand, it seems like until we don't have a number, everybody's waiting for the number to see how we move forward. So we have a little bit of a chicken and egg problem here, because on one hand, we don't declare it a crisis because we don't know how big the number is. On the other hand, until we don't know the number, we cannot really act as if it was a crisis. The first question, I think, for all of you, but maybe we'll start with Mr. Reynolds. Do you have estimations that you consider reliable, or what are your expectations, the UNHCR expectations for the years of people that will leave the country in 2008 and 19? How do you deal with this problem that we don't really have a number?
Right. Well, we do have some numbers, and I think some of them have been referenced. And the numbers I used, the 1.5 million who have left Venezuela already, these are, as I said, conservative governmental estimates. We need to be careful not to get too tied up in a numbers game, just like too tied up in a legal game, because we are talking about people in need. most importantly. And there are sometimes political, socioeconomic, and other reasons why governments may be a little shy at expressing all numbers, or in some cases, in some parts of the world, we've seen numbers expanded by governments, and we haven't found the people. So, you know, there's lots of various reasons for some shyness. I mean, I'd point back to the Middle East situation where, you know, you look at the Lebanese government numbers originally and what they are today, and for a year or two, they weren't really meeting simply because there was a political, an internal political crisis that's happening. And you have to remember and put that in context. I mean, even in a country like Colombia, which is going out and doing a new registration, which UNHCR and IOM are supporting, this administrative registry of Venezuelan migrants, in order to help get better numbers and a better handle on what's going on. You know, there are elections coming up. This is clearly, you know, the issue of population flows is an electoral issue. I mean, we look, I'm a United States national. I look at my own country where, you know, we're 320 million people, and a refugee admissions program of under 100,000 is a huge political event in certain elections. So, you know, we have to give some leeway on that. I think, as I had mentioned before, UNHCR's approach is really a needs-based as opposed to a status-based approach. And we see the people there. We have a lot of teams that work cooperatively with the U.S. government on the, and you were there at the border. You probably saw some of our dedicated staff there working with the host governments. So yes, the numbers are important when it comes to appeals and so on, and we'd like to get the most accurate numbers, but I think it's also important to recognize the need that's there and appreciate that the numbers probably are higher. But we're all going to play the international political diplomatic game that we need to play and approach it from a humanitarian perspective.
I'm asking this, Ms. Freeman, because I think that, I mean, what's also striking to me is that on one hand, the Colombian government for, I mean, I suspect there could be political reasons or not. They're doing a lot of efforts, putting a lot of efforts on the ground, but they're not willing to recognize this as a crisis. And then I thought to myself, well, if you're not, but at the same time, they are requesting for more resources. So for the health system, for the school system. So I told them, well, if you don't have a crisis and you want more resources, go to the World Bank or to the IDB and get some loans. So I agree that, you know, the numbers, we're talking about people, and the numbers are, on one hand, it's just a measure, but I think it does play a role when it comes to aid that could come to help these people on the ground. So how do you deal with that? I mean, your sense, this $2.5 million is a grant that is very standard to countries that on a rolling basis would need, or is this something that could be much higher if there's really a declaration of a crisis in the region?
As I think, as everybody has pointed out, the brotherhood, the fraternity within the region, nobody wants to embarrass the other. And so it puts everyone in a very difficult situation when it comes to declaring the numbers or calling it a disaster or not calling it a disaster. And so what we have done is to look at it from a needs-based approach. And we will continue to do that as we look at the region itself. We're very, very concerned about the numbers, obviously, and we're looking to HCR and IOM to continue to come up with the best figures that we possibly can. One of the things that we had been discussing earlier was the fact that, you know, the first wave of people were fairly well off that left, and the second a little less well off, and the third a little less well off. So as that grows and continues, and as people are away from their livelihoods, their status will continue to deteriorate unless they can find gainful employment or have other means of support. And so there are many factors that are going to complicate the numbers that we see coming out. That said, we will the program that we've stood up right now. Was really based on a situation along the border with the migrants being threatened, and also looking at the transnational threats One of the things that we were very, very concerned about was the measles epidemic that was crossing over the border, because children were not receiving vaccinations. And so we were starting to see in an area that heretofore had been at a fairly steady state, was seeing rises in cases of measles. So when the situation starts to then infiltrate and affect the other countries in the region, it begins to elevate that in everyone's eyes, particularly when you see pandemic sort of situations. So we will be watching for those kinds of triggers as we look at the migrant population throughout the region.
Ms. Youth, I want to give you a chance to add something on the numbers if you have, but I also have an additional question, which is also in the U.S. we see a lot of Venezuelans that have arrived in the past 20 years. I think most of them who arrived in the early years are people that are well off, and they definitely are, for the most part, able to settle here on their own. But I wonder now if the U.S. is contemplating a scenario where it would provide also temporary protection status or some other sort of status for Venezuelans who are fleeing right now from the country.
Thanks, Danny. So on the numbers, as Matt and Karen said, it's not, there's not like some kind of scale and you hit a certain number and then you say, well, now they need help. And PRM, that's why we're monitoring what is happening in the field, what kinds of conditions people are in, what kind of things are happening, is there sexual exploitation? Is there labor exploitation? What are the medical conditions and so forth? And so, more than anything else, we keep an eye on indicators and try to find solutions for that. And also one of the things that Matt was talking about early on when he was talking about how many people have applied for asylum and how many people have some kind of alternative visa or residency status. That's one of the things that we do a lot in terms of advocacy with governments on, because someone without status, somebody who has, no document, no, kind of laminated card that they can show I am, registered and or I have a visa or I have something, that puts them in a very, very vulnerable situation. And so in terms of, Karen was mentioning transnational concerns. Well, there's also the concerns of transnational crime, because if you have someone who needs a job, has hungry children to feed, and has no status, where will they turn? And who will look to them as a potential employee, so to speak. And so those are the kinds of things that we're encouraging governments in the region to really continue in their generosity in terms of giving people status. In terms of temporary protective status here in the United States, that has been used on and off for many things. I just recently I was remembering that it was even used during the Ebola crisis for folks who were here in the States, and then lifted maybe 6 months after. I've not heard any indication, and the Department of Homeland Security makes that determination on when to use TPS, so I don't really know what the criteria are. But I know that there are many Venezuelans have come to the United States, and a good number are asylum seekers as well.
And I think that what you're saying is key in the sense that a lot of these people don't even have documentation, and because the system is, there's simply no money to print passports. And I'm well off Venezuela, and I don't have a passport for a year. So if somebody at the embassy is listening to me, please. I've applied for a renewal. It took 6 months for them to give me an appointment to go to the consulate here, and then it's been 7 months, and I still haven't seen the passport. So can you imagine people that are really, who never had a passport before, who are don't have the financial resources to go through to get this documentation? That's why you see a lot of irregulars crossing the border, and that's a big issue. Before I turn to the public for some questions, I want to I'll tell you. I mean, the reason I asked about the numbers, I agree that, you know, we should care less about the numbers and care more about the needs. But the numbers are important to budget the needs. So I have a few questions for all of you. And you know, if the numbers that we are seeing that are coming out and that will keep coming out of the country are significant. There could be in the next, I mean, if this flow continues, and there's no reason to think that it wouldn't because the government there hasn't shown any signs of dealing with the internal situation, you could see 1 million more Venezuelans living in the next year or two, out of which a big portion of them could be actually classified, it would be in the need of humanitarian assistance. So I together with Sebastian, who works here at Brookings, we crossed some numbers. And we compared the cost of a Syrian refugee into countries like Germany and Turkey and Jordan for the very basic protection, which is, to my understanding, people who are living in refugee camps, giving them food and health and basic services for a year. And if the cost there varies from $3,000 to $10,000. If we adjust this to the cost of living in Colombia and the region, we have a number that is around $2,500 to $4,000. So if you think that 1 million people will leave, or even 500,000 people will leave in the need of humanitarian assistance in the next year or two, we're talking about the most basic protection, the most basic cost, which, by the way, refugee camps are not great for integration. So that would be like the worst possible scenario. We're talking about $1.5 billion. That the region will need to cover the basic needs of these people who are fleeing and need humanitarian aid. So that's why I'm talking about the numbers, because we do need to have a figure in order to understand whether the resources that have been put forward so far are a great start, but are only a start. So how do you envision? If we would need to create a fund that is that big of $1.5 billion. Who would kick in that fund? Who leads that effort? Like how in comparison to other crises, like how big these funds have been, and who are the main contributors to these funds? So I don't know if you want to on the UN side, maybe you can tell us a little bit about
sure.
that.
Sure. I mean, a couple of things. First, every sort of crisis or situation of this nature is very different, so it's somewhat difficult sometimes to compare different regions, given the socio sort of economic and status of Latin America and South America, it is greater than, for example, the crisis that we're dealing with places like Bangladesh, which are much poorer, and where the absorption capacity is much smaller. I mean, so I think that's important. I think the second thing to remember, too, is that, and this is very true for South America and the region, is that, and is increasingly true throughout the world, that the majority of refugees and others are not ever in a camp, that in fact it's quite urbanized, and they're now taken in by host communities. So when we're looking at the costs and looking at how to help people the best, it's actually a community-based approach as opposed to that individual refugee or asylee or whatever status you want to give them, but it's in fact helping that community where they are. That community is oftentimes stressed and poor itself, and you actually can help integration and help acceptance much better. Instead of building a separate school for the refugee, you're actually building a better school for the entire town. So those are important factors to keep in mind. I think there's another factor here that's often overlooked, and I appreciate my colleagues here for raising it before, is actually the real generosity, acceptance, and sort of forward progress that South America has in accepting others from its communities. There is quite a bit of integration. Some of it is relatively simple in the sense that everyone speaks Spanish. You know, it's and there's a lot of cross-border movement anyway. I think the other factor that plays in here, which may be different than some other areas, is that the real answer here and what really needs to happen and is being pushed is really a regional approach, because this is a regional issue. And you're seeing, you know, if you take, let's compare it to another huge crisis we have, which is Syria. And while you had a lot of Syrians leave, the vast majority of Syrian refugees are actually still within Syria, they're IDP. But you also have 5 million, but they're staying. It's Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. And those are the immediate bordered countries. With Venezuelans, and because of things like Mercosur and so many other regional approaches that have occurred, Venezuelans are not just staying in Colombia. We're seeing every day thousands leave Colombia and go to Ecuador, Ecuador to Chile, Chile to Argentina, Brazil. Now, we're now seeing a northern movement that's occurring up to Central America towards the United States, and particularly, and of course, this, the poor Caribbean countries, which really get overwhelmed very, very, very quickly. Remember, it's literally seven. You can see Trinidad and you can see Aruba from Venezuela. So the regional approach is extremely important. And I think one of the things that UNHCR, I think, and other UN families, our close partner, IOM, are very involved in, is really trying to promote and work a regional approach. And that's where you're going to, I think, get better understanding of what the numbers, just not numbers, but the needs and the importance are. Because if we just measure it of someone crossing that Colombian border and say, aha, that means that this Venezuela is in Colombia, that number and that need for aid may not actually be accurate, because that family very well may be moving to Ecuador or even coming to northern Brazil, which is very tight. They may actually be ending up in Sao Paulo a month or two from then. So it's a complicated process, but there are people a lot smarter than me at UNHCR who do this, who are helping our partners figure that out.
Before I go on to you, I want to push in terms of the finance in particular, because the $46 million, do you foresee this as a first step? And do you foresee that UNHCR or the UN system in general are thinking in the dimensions that we talked about before of like, even if it's a regional issue of 500,000 people who would be in the need of humanitarian assistance, are there talks about it? Do you see this $46 million as a start to something that could be bigger if things get worse, or?
Yes, sadly, I'm afraid it is more of a first step, and not necessarily based on specifics of this crisis, but just of the generalities that have occurred in the world over the last 25 years. We're finding every new crisis becomes much greater and much longer and much more protracted, and we have to be thinking that way and be prepared for it. We can, you know, prepare for the worst and hope for the best.
Do you want to jump in on the finance side and the size of the aid?
Well, you know, we're seeing this across the spectrum of the protraction of situations, and yes, we do need the numbers in order to budget out for the responses. But what we also need a lot more of. On the one hand, responding to the need is the involvement of the local communities, the absorption notion in the area, the involvement of the local governments, all the governments around the within the region, not only on the care of these people who are flooding into their countries, but also their involvement in pressuring the government of Venezuela to resolve this problem. The solution will not come unless that is done. And it you know, it's all well and good to have, you know, the United States and others to apply that pressure, but it's much more important for those who have a very vested interest that don't want to see their children being infected by diseases that they don't need to be infected by because they're coming over the border because the country has let its health system die, to put their own pressure on that government. The humanitarian crises that we see today more and more are man-made crises, and they must have a political solution. Otherwise, the humanitarian budgets that you refer to will have to continue to grow and grow and grow, and they can't ad infinitum. So it really becomes incumbent upon the governments in the region to join in that effort. They may not have all of the financial resources to provide the humanitarian assistance, but they most certainly have the political influence, and they need to use that.
I'm going to be straight with this next question, a follow-up question. So this initial package the USAID is giving, are there talks that you can share with other governments in which that like to, in terms of expanding this aid, or how do you foresee, if you cannot tell us about the talks, how do you foresee this package increasing in the next year, if at all?
I mentioned earlier that we're looking at and working with IOM and others on looking at what the flow is. Where are people going? Who's going where? And what their needs are wherever they're going. Because they're putting pressure on other systems. So what those needs are, we've got to kind of figure that out before we can sort of decide what the needs are that need to be responded to. We will respond to those needs that cannot otherwise be met. And no, I can't get ahead of my boss in terms of numbers. But I will say that we are looking at our resources and looking at what we can work on.
Thank you. Ms. Youth, I don't know if you want to jump a little bit into your views.
I'll just give
finance,
just
right?
Yeah. So I won't give them to Danny, even though I know he wants to crunch the numbers. But so even though I just said, well, we don't really focus on the numbers, obviously, if we're doing our due diligence and we're funding things, we can't just say, well, the numbers be damned and we'll just, you know, fund whatever. So, you know, we have this very intricate chart that we keep and guard in our office where we kind of have what the official host government estimates are of the numbers, what UNHCR estimates, what IOM estimates, because IOM has their data tracking mechanism, and so everybody counts a little differently, you know. And also, since we all of our posts in the field, we've encouraged them to report, so they're also reporting. And anyway, we keep track of this chart just so we, you know, we can kind of do a better job knowing what we're funding. But I will also say that, you know, one of the things that, in fact, I just wrote Matt a note just to make sure that I was correct in this, but, you know, one of the things that I think is a powerful comment as well is that, so it's only recently that UNHCR put out this $46 million appeal, and yet they already have $1 million in contributions from private U.S. entities and citizens, right? And so, and that speaks also of, that's another part, piece of the puzzle. It's not just the U.S. government, and it's not just other governments in the region and then other governments beyond the region. It's also individuals who see this, it touches them, and they also choose to contribute. You should know that when we decide, when we're looking at an appeal and we're deciding to use U.S. taxpayer money to fund it, you know, we take it very seriously, our stewardship of U.S. taxpayer money. And so one of the things that we always include when we're considering funding an appeal is we have a section of our process where we talk about what we're going to do to encourage other donors to share the burden. And so with all of these things, that is always part of our strategy, how we're going to approach other countries that are traditional donors, other non-traditional donors. If we think this is important enough to spend U.S. taxpayer money on, then we also think it's important enough to talk to our friends and allies and encourage them as well to share some of that burden.
Thank you. I have many more questions to ask, but I do want to give some questions to the public. So why don't we start here with this gentleman in the third row. Please present yourself shortly and make sure your comment ends with a question mark.
Hi, my name is Diego Sharifker. I'm from Caracas, Venezuela. I just moved here to the U.S. 2 weeks ago. I'm a city council member, elected official in Caracas, and I'll be studying a master's degree here in Washington. My question mainly begins with, well, Ms. Freeman stated that there's different waves of Venezuelans that have left. I can state two of them. A friend of mine who graduated as an architect in a very prestigious university in Caracas left to Argentina by bus maybe a year ago, and he's working as a waiter now in a restaurant in Argentina. And then there's another friend who just left Venezuela with only $20 in his pocket towards Colombia and seeing what's going to happen after that. So my main question is, for example, Chile now just created a democratic responsibility visa for Venezuelans to go to Chile. Surely it's going to be, they are going to have to pay for them in Venezuela in dollars. And while minimum wage is only $2 a month, it's going to be very hard for a Venezuelan to pay to be able to begin the process to obtain a visa to be able to move over to Chile. So my question mainly for Mr. Reynolds would be, what recommendations do you have for Latin American countries when trying to legalize the status of Venezuelans in their countries? Because if you have to charge people to be able to start a process and the minimum wage isn't enough to be able to pay the process, how could they legally leave Venezuela and become migrants or refugees in other countries? That's all. Thank you.
Yeah, quite simply, that's just one of the things we ask host countries to do, is to appreciate the circumstances of those who are coming and address it in that way. Maybe waive a fee or lower a fee or find ways to break through obstacles to accelerate registration processes, to appreciate that the people are there and are in need of protection and assistance. And it's in the best interests of that government to have individuals registered, to have them legalized, so that they're not in an irregular or even drawn into or forced into an illegal situation. Narco gangs and so on are very, very prevalent. So it's very important for a country's own national security interests to cooperate. And we're finding that they are very receptive. The host countries are very receptive to this. Some, as I was mentioning, the Southern Caribbean, some have never faced this sort of situation before. So the UN family, not only UNHCR, but ILM and others, are helping provide sort of examples and instructions and guidance on how to accelerate that sort of giving some sort of a legal and protected status that's important.
More questions? Here, the lady here in the third row.
Hi, and thank you again for sharing your experiences. My name is Ana Aguilera. I work as an urban specialist in the World Bank. I would be interested to learn a little bit more, and some of you mentioned this in the panel, about what are your estimates, given what we have seen in other countries, in other regions, of the size of the needs and the top priorities for host communities. In particular, say in the short term, talking about local price inflation, food security, and things like that. Thanks.
Who wants to
start?
Ms. Freeman, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I'm processing. in terms of the local communities, what we do try to do and what we are working with WFP on in the program in Colombia is to use the local market. So we use tools like vouchers rather than just commodities. So there is a sensitivity to the local economy in the areas that the program is operating. The other thing I think that when we prioritize is to look at carefully at the local systems, be they education or health or food delivery and food security. To see which ones are being impacted the most, and therefore gauge our response to that. But it is a do no harm attitude that we take to try to make sure that the well-being of the local community is taken into due consideration, and that will have to be the case as we look at other groups and other populations, what the situation is in the local community.
So you want to add something, or yeah, please.
And you know, it is on a case by case basis, right? So some countries have like one piece of the puzzle, like shelter, all figured out, and so they don't have to, you know, that they that's not the thing that needs to be focused on. And then other countries, you know, sometimes it's the health issue, which I think is probably throughout the region a great focus. But, you know, I had jotted down some of the things that I have seen that in talking to local governments that they were talking about. So some places they wanted technical training for people, job placement, how to train people on self-employment so that they can get livelihoods right away. Some places were through UNHCR and IOM and others were working with border authorities, right, to help build capacity, because not that they didn't have capable border authorities, but you know they weren't quite expecting the numbers and kind of dealing with that. Sometimes it's local authorities don't have the ability to monitor people with special needs it's doing the registration, it's helping train people to assess. You know, in Boa Vista, when I was there, one of the things that I was truly impressed with, and this is not to compliment UNHCR too much, but you know he'll be nice to me in the next question, so it's probably good. But so in Boa Vista, I mean, they are very isolated. Roraima State is very far from anything else, right? And so all of these people are coming in, and unlike in Colombia and other places where, well, they're just hopping on a bus and moving through, many of them have been concentrating in Boa Vista, and so it's very difficult for them to register everyone, do anything. And the UNHCR folks there very creatively talked, you know, tried to figure out, so this not uber populated part of Brazil, what is it, how can we use local resources to kind of grapple with this? And they worked with the local University of Roraima. And they said, okay, you've got all of these young, bright college students who are looking for experience in the world. What if they started working with the local police to do the initial registration of people, not like the adjudication of, you know, do you get a res, but at least, you know, the filing, the initial interview, the setting up the appointments and all of that. They get a little stipend, they get a job, maybe they get credits at university, and this takes the burden off of people who otherwise would be doing this when they should be doing adjudication. And so it's kind of going in and looking at what the situation is, what the needs are, and seeing what locally, what kind of solutions there are. And even in that same instance with Roraima, I admired that. So the University of Roraima had a building that they had half built, and they hadn't finished building it, and they ran out of money, I guess, for construction. They were waiting to finish it. And one of the suggestions that UNHCR did was they helped finish the construction of that, and they said, okay, we'll use this as a reception center for Venezuelan migrants coming in, and it will be a one-stop shop, because in many places, when a migrant comes in or a refugee comes in and they want to apply for refugee status and they want to get a document so that they can work on the market, or they want to see somebody about a medical issue, they end up kind of getting shopped all over town, right? And these are people with limited means, and perhaps, and in the case of Brazil, they don't even speak the language, many of them, because they've come as Spanish speakers. And so to have like a one-stop shop where somebody, a vulnerable migrant who comes in, can hop in here and see all of the people they need to see in one place, I mean, is just a gift for them. And it also is helpful in getting them on the path to integration right away. So, that's not going to be the case probably anywhere else, right? But every situation calls for, you know, a solution specific to the situation.
And I just want to add to that with my economist hat, that actually when you look at the evidence on economics of migration, most of the evidence shows that migrants are actually positive to the local economies. Because migrants don't only take somebody's job, that also depends on how the skills of the migrants that are typically complementary to those of the natives. But migrants are entrepreneurs, they create jobs, they eat, they wear clothes, so they also contribute to the local economy. So I think a lot of those issues that are really important in this case, when we're talking about capacitations and integration, that migrants per se are very entrepreneurial. And I saw a lot of that, actually. I saw people that were, selling phone accessories, but I also, I bought this amazing wallet that was made with Venezuelan bills. It's on my Twitter, so you can see it. It was beautiful. The bills are worth like less than 1 cent of a dollar, each bill. And can you imagine what these people could do if they had a little bit of seed capital and a little bit of business training? they could make wonders. They could really create a lot of jobs. So I think that we, here at Brookings, at least me, I'm trying to with research, to battle that misconception that migrants are negative. And we're going to keep working on the Venezuelan case in particular, on thinking how to integrate those to the local economies and to the labor force. And we have some plans with some partners, and we're always looking for partners to help. So let's get some more questions. This gentleman here in the middle. The mic is coming to you.
Hey, good morning to everyone. I'm Eric Fajardo from Catholic Charities, the Migration and Office, Refugee Office. I think it's one of the biggest resettlement agencies in this area. And just for practical curiosity, we would like to know that if, given the comprehension the government has about the Venezuelan phenomena, and obviously the political sympathy, it's clearly on the table, is just to know if we need to be prepared for someone else. It's in the plans of the government to approve, clearly not a TPS program, but something like a refugee program, a special refugee program. My question goes because since the last year, we've been receiving pretty much good number of Venezuelan asylees. And we would like to know if, given the situation in Venezuela and the full comprehension the government seems like to have about this phenomena, is in plans or in progress any kind of refugee program? We just want to be prepared. Everyone is welcome, and our agency probably resettled many of the asylees from Central America lately, but we would like to know if we need to prepare more codes. That's all.
Thank you. Is that for you?
Yeah. So no. As I said, with TPS, it's not been in my. I've not heard anything about any consideration, but that would be out of the Department of Homeland Security. And in terms of any kind of special refugee program, that also has, as far as I know, has not been discussed. There have been, over the past 2 years, a spike in asylum applications from Venezuelans in the United States. And those are being processed just, but along with all the other asylum applications. And but there, I'm not aware of any kind of special program.
I follow up on that, Mr. Reynolds.
But let me just say, just call out Catholic Relief Services for their... In many places that I have been during this trip, there has been a lot of excellent work done by Catholic Relief Services and a number of religious NGOs, very impressive. And those are the kind of things that when we're looking at NGO programs, the gaps, the things that NGOs are able to kind of focus on that is so helpful in these situations.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I want to follow up quickly with Mr. Reynolds because you are in the USA office. So the U.S. didn't sign the Cartagena Declaration. But are there legal grounds in the U.S. so that eventually these people could be recognized as refugees if there's a need in an easier way?
Well, I mean, the U.S. has all kinds of its own internal laws, which are compliant, obviously, with all of the protocols and conventions. The U.S. is right now, along with Spain, are the two primary providers of asylum, of legal asylum for Venezuelans showing up at their borders. So I mean, that's really the U.S. has been, I think, very generous. It is even for all refugees, it is still the number one resettlement country of admissions. And we hope that not only the U.S. but others will give that opportunity to the most vulnerable to be resettled.
I'm asking this in the context that the U.S. has recently significantly lowered the number of admittances for refugees. So when we're thinking about TPS and further measures, I know you told me it's the Homeland Security Department, but do you foresee that in the case of Venezuela it could be different than what we've seen in the past year or two, the behavior towards Syrian refugees, or will it be part of the same legal framework?
It's all part of the same legal framework.
I want a female to have some gender balance, so over there, please.
Thank you. My name is Margarita Mayra. I come from Smart Citizen Foundation, Fundación Ciudadano Inteligente in Chile. We're an NGO and we work to all around the region to promote, strengthen Latin American democracies. So I was one, well, I'm a fellow here at NED for the moment, but I'll be going back. And I wonder, you just mentioned it again, that NGOs are filling in the gaps, you were saying. I was wondering what kind of work is it that you value that they are doing to actually help tackle this problem? Because we haven't figured out a way to help Venezuela from my organization yet, but we might be looking at that. So how can we be useful? Or how are they being useful, NGOs in general? Okay. Thank you.
NGOs. Well, I don't know if that's your territory, Ms. Youth, or...
Yeah, I think that is my territory. I'm trying to find my... I anticipated that someone would ask, which is good. and I kind of cut and pasted a little detail a bit from our NOFO, which now, of course, I can't find. Just off the top of my head, one of the things that we've been funding many NGOs in the region already for Colombian refugees, right? Because there are Colombian refugees in Venezuela, they're in Ecuador, they're in Costa Rica. So the programs that are done there, there's a lot of NGOs that do legal assistance. So this whole documentation thing, very problematic. So while I was in Colombia, I also went to see some of our programs for internally displaced Colombians. And so when the people who come out without documentation, and it's not just documentation of citizenship, sometimes it's documentation of education and so forth, to work your way through the bureaucracy, any government bureaucracy, if you've got a limited education or limited resources, is very difficult. So NGOs, some that we fund, will have staff members, you know, kind of young, determined, insistent people who will help people work their way towards the bureaucracy to get the services that they should be getting, not anything special, but just, or to get the documentation they need so that they can get their kid into school. Or in the case when I was in Colombia, what I saw was there are Colombians who are coming out of Venezuela. They went there, they married, and so they've come out now and they're a mixed family. They've got a Venezuelan spouse and children who might not have documentation. So what they need is somebody to help them kind of go through the whole bureaucracy of getting the right kind of documentation. Other things, livelihoods programs. So the when I was talking about technical training and those kind of things, or teaching people self-employment skills, or sometimes NGOs will do programs on sexual and gender-based violence, and specifically, you know, working with education and conscious raising so that people kind of understand the warning signs and how to protect their children and so forth. So there's a variety of things that folks do. While others are talking, I'm going to flip through my documents one more time to see if I can find our NOFO information.
Yeah. It just typically looking at not only ourselves but the partners whom we're working with. So, for instance, the World Food Program that we're working with in Colombia right now, looking at programs on nutrition education, looking at programs on community mobilization, on public health, all of those things to empower the local community to be able to care for itself. One of the things that is very prominent in the way USAID is thinking these days is that journey towards self-reliance. And so these kinds of programs we really use as opportunities to reach out and help the help communities to learn how to cope with these kinds of crises as they arise. This isn't the last one, and this isn't the first one, and it's not the last one. And so building that kind of capacity in the local community to be able to assess the needs and the stressors on their systems is very, very important. And organizations such as your own are particularly well adapted to be able to strengthen the local community systems.
I want to take the few questions together because we need to wrap up. So if you can just make them short, there's a gentleman there.
So.
And then we can also have our closing statement.
I'm Mark Hetfield. I'm the president of HIAS, which is the American Jewish Communities Refugee Agency, and we work in partnership with UNHCR, NPRM, and four countries in South America that are impacted by the Venezuelan crisis. Two short follow-up questions. One, the UNHCR guidance note in March, and this is for Matt, was very clear about the need that countries not return Venezuelans back to Venezuela at this time. So have you taken it the next step in the United States for UNHCR to specifically call upon the United States to give TPS to Venezuelans? And question for Marta, there was a report in McClatchy News Service last night that the United States is, in fact, talking to other countries in the region about the United States accepting, through our resettlement program, Venezuelans for the first time. Can you confirm or elaborate on that report?
Let's take one more. Here we have the front, the third row.
Hi, my name is Audrey Vilanovic. I'm with the Human Migration Remittance Program at the Inter-American Dialogue. And so my question about remittances, kind of talking about the community and economy back in Venezuela, are the migrants who are leaving Venezuela from your experiences at the border, are they planning on sending remittances back, and how much and in what manner? Thank you.
So let me answer that first with my economist hat, and then we can go through the questions and some closing remarks. I think that there's a lot of remittances happening today in kind. I think that there's a lot of people sending food and medicines and so on, not so much sending money because there's really no mechanisms. There's no cash in Venezuela. There are no enough bills because of the hyperinflation. So we see a lot of that, and that has been increasing. It's hard to know whether, I presume that there's going to be much more remittances and cash flowing in somehow, but the system is really in the moving all the time, so we don't really know how is that going to work. But some sort of remittances are going to go and help the population that are left behind, for sure. So I don't know if you want to take, there were a few questions and also some concluding remarks. Should we do it in this order?
Sure. So, HIAS, another great partner of ours, providing legal assistance, among other things, but also livelihoods and psychosocial support for Colombian refugees. Your question on the McClatchy story, which I also saw and kind of said, this is news to me too. I cannot confirm that story. I'm not aware of that at all. And in terms of remittances, so interestingly, when I was in Boa Vista, I noticed when I was in, there was a park where there were a lot of Venezuelans, and I noticed people had receipts from Western Union. And so I asked about it, and people said they were sending money back. So then I went back to the hotel and Googled, and I saw that there were Western Union offices in Venezuela. So obviously some remittances are going back that way. But then, just anecdotally talking to people, there were many people who said that they were there for, a week, or they were there for a couple months, and they were collecting, they were like saving up their money, and they were going to buy things and go back. And so I think that in some ways, and I also just heard through word of mouth that people also had, somebody from their village who would go back every month, and everybody would give them, money or things to take back. So there's a lot of movement back and forth, and just as we were chatting earlier on, there's also, it appears to be there are more people moving within Venezuela towards the border areas because of the availability of goods and medicines and so forth on the other side, which will enable them to continue living in Venezuela while benefiting from the ability to purchase things that maybe are not so available there.
Well, as you know, TPS is a sovereign decision for the United States. So UNHCR, you know, we're not involved in granting or doing that. We have seen a number of Venezuelans coming and seeking asylum, and their cases are being processed. They're coming into the United States. And we have encouraged all countries, including the United States, to look at whatever form that they're comfortable with doing, alternative sort of means of protecting Venezuelans in need. If the U.S. were to choose, and it's, you know, that TPS is an option they'd like to use, that's one of the available options. Obviously, there's an asylum route that individuals are taking. So different countries approach it in different ways, but we certainly encourage all to provide the kind of international protection that these individuals desperately need.
Thank you. Do you want to have some closing remarks, there was...
Well, certainly I want to thank you all here at Brookings again for raising this, and it is a topic that we will be watching into the future, not only presently in Colombia but in Brazil, Ecuador, Trinidad, Tobago, as we continue to understand the numbers and the needs that are out there. I would also again enter the plea to the region and those working within the region. The humanitarian needs today are just astounding, and the humanitarian community will always try to keep up, and as our administrators often want to say, we will stand beside our brothers when they need assistance. But we need to count on self-responsibility as well. And the humanitarian crisis that's causing this great outflux will not end until the root causes are resolved.
Yeah, I'd just like to say thank you again for sponsoring, for Brookings for sponsoring this, for all of you for caring. And I know many in the, and I'm here with the U.S. government to again thank the U.S. It is UNHCR's largest contributor. It's always very generous. And since we're really, really close to tax filing time, remember that, folks. We really appreciate that very much, because it's the American support goes a long, long way all over the world. I really hope that this and other kind of panels help generate a lot of positive support and recognition of the crisis. And I look forward to coming back to Brookings when we're going to talk about all the others, Bangladesh, Africa, Congo, South Sudan. Sadly, there are so many crises in the world that need attention today. But thank you again for inviting UNHCR.
Thank you.
Thank you, Danny, Ted.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much to all of you, really, for coming and all the work that you or your organizations are doing as a Venezuelan. I really thank you for your help, and to all of you here in the panel for the amazing work and help that you have been providing and that you will keep providing in larger amounts, hopefully. thank you so much for